Welcome to the Independent Artist Podcast, sponsored by the National Association of Independent Artists.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. I'm Will Armstrong, and I'm a mixed media artist.
I'm Douglas Sigworth, a glassblower. Join us as we explore the topics that affect the lives and livelihoods of art show artists.
Douglas, it's great to hear your voice and start this podcast thing back again. We've had a little bit of a hiatus, but we're back at it. And welcome back to the Independent Artist.
Yeah, we're back down from the mountains. We're getting oxygen back to our brains again. So it feels pretty good.
It was good to finally meet you, you know, to actually sit in your booth and hang out and talk with you and your lovely wife, Renee, and actually get to see you face to face in human being form.
It was great. I had a great time. It was totally fun and made some good sales, so it was all good. Everything about the weekend was nice.
I was thinking a lot about COVID, obviously, and I was having a conversation with my wife, and she and I were talking about the assumed risks as art show artists and what we go through. You know, William Kwamina Poe talking about not wanting to do Texas because of open carry laws and being a person of color.
Right.
Thinking about COVID. COVID becomes just an assumed risk now. And another thing is just traveling to and from shows. And you had a little bit of a story on the way. And I'm really, really anxious for the folks to hear your story about how you got to the show and listening to your own instincts.
It was really weird because I've been traveling now for over 20 years and I've had a lot of experiences. And this was a new one for me. So it actually started back driving home from Ann Arbor, you know, a couple months ago. And I see off in the distance this goose entering the freeway going through Chicago. And I'm sure that the semi on my right is going to take it out. But somehow it made its way under the trailer of the semi and into my front passenger side wheel.
Ooh, like a goose? Like a big bird?
A big bird. That thing just, I didn't even brake because I knew it doesn't weigh that much. And I wasn't going to risk, you know, swerving out of control over a goose.
Yeah, no way. Were you taking the trailer at that point or no?
Nope. I had just packed the van. I hadn't gotten the whole trailer thing worked out at that point.
Gotcha.
So it's just a one and done kind of there and back kind of thing with just the van.
Yeah.
So the goose is obliterated, but almost immediately I started to develop just this tiny little wobble. I thought, oh, great. Knocked the wheel out of balance or my alignment or something, but it felt minor. I could still go 70 miles an hour and it was not a big deal. And then I got home and started getting ready for this tour and put it out of my mind because there were just a lot more pressing things going on.
Of course.
Until we start driving to Park City, and I got the trailer hooked up, and I'm like, ah, damn, that little wobble is there at 70 miles an hour. This sucks. I should have dealt with this.
So only when you get up high, like only when you're really up high and the speed is up to notch.
Yes. And I thought, well, 70 miles an hour, big deal. Little wobble wasn't that big of a deal, minor, but it got progressively worse and worse and worse. And so for us to get to Park City, it was two really long days in the van. And the first day we get about 10, 12 hours in. We have a little more than half left, hop in the vehicle the next day. And then that's when it got bad. And it got really remote heading into Colorado and getting close to Utah. There's no place to stop and look at it. But then it was like at 55 miles an hour, my steering wheel was violently shaking.
Ooh.
I kept pulling off at rest stops. I took all of the lug nut covers off and tightened all the lug nuts down, thinking maybe I had a loose wheel. I was going crazy.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I was totally going crazy trying to diagnose this and figure out what's going to happen. It took me 16 and a half hours to get to Park City, completely stressed out.
Said, what's the typical drive time?
I probably could have gotten to Park City normally on a 10-hour day. That's what was left, but it was an extra 6 hours with the slower speeds and all the stops to check things out.
Brutal.
Basically, I'd say, well, it's an alignment. I'm going to have the alignment checked on Monday, do the show, put it out of my mind. But before I go on to the next show, I'm getting this figured out. Took it into a shop on Monday. They looked at it. They said, hey, you've got no front end issues. Your bearings are good. Your tie rods are good. No loose lug nuts. Balanced your wheels. Took it out for a road test. You are good to go. So I thought it was a thing of the past. Get in the van and trailer, start heading towards Idaho. Again, nothing was changed. It was the same situation. I call him back.
Same wobble, same everything.
Same everything. Nothing was better. Call him back. he said, hey, we looked the whole thing over. You're good to go. Just trust me, man. You're good to go. Just keep on going. Fix it when you get home.
Fix it. Fix what, though? If everything's good to go, fix what when you get home?
Well, that
clearly there's something wrong.
Something's wrong.
Right.
So I know that if I pass Salt Lake City, then I'm, again, remote and I'm not going to have any options. So I found a Chevy dealership. They said, we can get you in Friday. I'm like, I need this looked at now. So I went to a tire dealership and said, can you look over the front end? Can you look over all this stuff? Well, they came out with this little scanner that looks like a cell phone, and they circulated all the tires and they got to the last tire, the back tire by the trailer on the driver's side. So complete opposite of the one that hit the goose. And they said, holy crap, your steel belt inside this tire is completely separated. Mm. And because your tire is only a couple of years old and you've got a lot of not much tire wear on it, it's only being held together by the tread.
Oh my God.
And he said, I don't know how you made it to here, but you avoided a blowout.
That's insane. So like when you're driving down the road and you see the rubber gaiters on the side of the road, it's generally from 18 wheelers. And that's what's happened. So it separates first, so the wheels start spinning, but then the radial stays kind of the same and it catches a different speed until it grinds its way out. And then they have a blowout, but they've got, 17 other wheels. You've just got the four and you're pulling a trailer.
And going up and down hills, that would have been devastating.
It would have been devastating. I don't know if you know one of my good friends, Michelle Martis, on the road. She was pulling a trailer and had a front end blowout and it jackknifed her rig.
Oh no.
And flipped her over, and she was lucky to be alive. I mean, it just gives you chills when you think about that and you think about what it could have been.
Yeah, well, this is one of those things where I want anyone who's listening, if you get anything similar to what I'm talking about, trust your gut, have it looked at. Don't wait until it goes. People responded to my social saying when they blew tires on the road, that was the similar response, that wobbling around at highway speeds. That's kind of the telltale sign.
I had a similar situation where I ignored a recall. And I was like, I can get down to Greenville and back. It's only a 7-hour drive. And I was getting ready to stop for the night. And it's right around my destination. And I take the exit. And I'd been going 80 miles an hour, just whipping down the road and having a good time, stopping for the night. Oh. So I take the exit, and all of a sudden, it's like I'm piloting a boat. Oh. Like, it just starts floating all around. I'm like, whoa, why does my wheel feel kind of unattached? I take the exit really slow it way down, pull into the closest parking lot, and there is a 5-star barbecue restaurant, a Fairfield Inn. I'm golden, but I turn into the parking space and the truck just stops like you've caught your toe on carpet.
Yeah.
And it's just like, guck, 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 guck. And so I jam on the brakes, hop out. My tire is perpendicular now to the road. Like it's just flat. One tire's one way and the other one is straight ahead. And I'm like, what the hell? And I climb underneath it. My tie rod is completely severed and it's barely jammed underneath the inside wheel well. So when I was steering it, it felt like a boat. The tie rod itself was nudging.
Uh-huh.
The axle is just nudging the tire.
Oh.
So it's like kind of pointing it in the right direction. And the fact that I'm driving straight is keeping it straight. And as soon as I took a hard turn to get it into a parking space, it just stopped. So when I got that thing towed into the shop, I happened to break down within towing range of a place that had already done work on this truck.
Okay.
So my same old shop tows me back to the garage, and I go and talk to my guy. He looks kind of shaken, and he's like, I've seen this happen before, but I've never seen somebody walk away from it.
Whoa.
He's like, when this happens, especially if you're on the highway, it just, if your tire flips in like that, you flip the truck, you're done. And it was like, yeah. I mean, like the luck that we have, assuming the risk, assuming this goddamn risk that we do, driving to shows, driving anywhere we're going to go. And I'm happy doing that. I'm happy assuming the risk. I'm happy assuming that the tire separations, idiot drivers, people texting while they're driving in order to get to shows. This is all part of it.
It is part of it.
It is. Yeah. This is all part of it. And now wearing masks and getting to shows and doing whatever you have to do in order to get the show, in order to get the permit is part of it too. So,
you know, last episode we were having a good old fashioned rant about the non-vaccinated and the kind of the surge that's coming back. And I still feel that way. That's not any different. But I guess I'm a little bit more okay and on board with, you know what, if we just have to put that cloth back on our mouth to keep the shows going so we can keep the people coming out, so we can keep people wanting to buy our work. It's like, I'm not going to complain about that aspect of it. Maybe like I sounded earlier.
I'll do whatever the show asks me to do, and I'm not going to give them a hard time about it because I know they've already gone through the hoops in order to get their permits, but I'm going to do some complaining. Like this Lollapalooza, if you look at the reports, and they everybody at Lollapalooza had to be vaccinated, and it is not showing to be a super spreader event.
Okay.
Being outside has proven to be fairly okay.
Yeah.
And then again, I'm not a scientist, but these are the reports that I've read that being outside is a lot safer than being inside as far as this virus goes and as far as spreading it. So I do think that it's ridiculous, but I understand where the shows are coming from and where they're at in order to make it happen and in order to make people mm-hmm. feel happy. Take Armonk, for example. Armonk is going on into September. Just got an email. They are requiring that artists wear their masks during setup, during show hours, and during breakdown, and also show proof of vaccination. And the way I'm looking at it, I'm like, look, it's a privately run event. That's your event. That's your rules. I want to go to Armonk, so I'm going to play by your rules. Am I happy that I'm going to wear their mask during setup and breakdown? No, I'm not happy.
Yeah.
It's a huge pain in the ass.
Well, maybe for them to be able to go on with the show, that's a requirement that was imposed on them. So it's like, okay, give them a break. Just let's just do it. I know we just dropped off the van and trailer in Portland because we're doing the Pearl in a couple of weeks and flew home. The minute we drove into Oregon, it's mask mandates everywhere. So anyone who's going out to do the Pearl, plan on going into hotels and gas stations and rest stops and all the stuff, restaurants, you're going to have the mask on because all the signs say masks required in order to enter. So they're really on top of it.
The way I feel about it, this is the way I feel back to Armonk again. It's your show. They are your rules. This is an unprecedented time. And if you want to do it, that's what it's going to be. And again, I don't have to be happy about it, but in order to participate, that's what we're going to do. That's fine. You know, go ahead. I know that shows are dealing with municipalities and laws that are imposed on them, and I'm not going to be the pain in the ass that goes and questions them because I'm just trusting they've already been through the ringer on it. So follow the rules. It's just these people that wear their masks around their chin make me insane. I know my sister, when she was flying out here to Minnesota, was sitting next to some asshole who was wearing it around his chin. It's like, look, private airline, it's their rules. In order to get the flights there on time, this is what people are dealing with. Wear the mask like they ask it. These are not the flight attendants' rules. These are the airline's rules. These are not the show's rules necessarily. They are the town's rules or the state's laws. So we're going to follow our thing in order to keep our shows, keep the wheels on the wagon. Do the right thing and just do what people ask and don't be a pain in the ass.
Well, let's face it. Last week, we just lost a couple. And I think all it takes is a couple of them going away and us saying, okay, we won't complain. We'll do what needs to be done. Just don't close. Please, don't close on us.
I know for a fact that a lot of the question marks around Jazz Fest closing last couple weeks ago, I guess, was the fact that they had a deadline coming up where they were going to have to pay their artists, whether the show went on or not, up to 50% of their fee.
The musician artists.
And, you know, we're not talking about my old rockabilly band, Hamburger James. We're talking about the Rolling Stones.
That's right.
Can you even imagine?
That's a serious buck there.
Seriously, what is 50% of the Stones' fee? I mean, it's got to be in the millions. So, you know, they're probably looking at bankrupting the show if they get the rug yanked out from underneath them. So, I don't know. I it's such a hard situation to be, and nobody knows how to do it. It's all new ground that we're walking on, you know, Doug?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
So it's all about assumed risk. You know, we assume the risk when we're driving to the shows. We know that our tires might blow out or our tie rods might break or our trucks might break down. And now we've got to know that we're going to have to go to shows where there might be COVID. And I know there are a lot of artists that don't want to do the shows. And you know what? Stay home. It's a huge bummer. But man, just stay home and try not to ruin it for the rest of us. I just hope that people aren't out there going, you've got to close down. You've got to close our businesses down. It's like we are predominantly showing outside or we're showing with vaccine cards. And it is a tough new world, but we're trying to weather it together. So I don't know. Be patient. Be kind. Follow the rules. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole. That should be like the running motto in people's head. Don't be an asshole. That's just
dude, if you've got to repeat that mantra in your head too late, you're already an asshole.
You might be an asshole.
Yeah, if you're sitting there just focusing on yourself, just going, good, just don't be an asshole. But seriously, get the shot. Listen to science and help us out and end this damn thing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I am so excited about being back on the road again is just seeing everybody again. I mean, I had so many great conversations with our friends out there and just talking about, you know, what they've been up to, what they're doing, where they're going, new ideas. COVID has taken a number on all of us, you know, but it changed us all in lots of different ways. And I'm just really enjoying hearing from everybody and all of the, you know, like, for example, some people were saying, oh, I didn't work for the longest time. I was just going for walks or I was riding my bike or doing this or that. And I felt really bad because I wasn't working on my art. But then when they came back to working on their art, they realized, well, wait, the inspirations that I drew on from this time is really fueling my work and it is sending me new directions. And so I'm feeling a lot of excitement and passion and fire going on here moving forward as people are back at shows, selling their work and having ideas for other work. It's a really exciting time, even though we're dealing with these stresses of the shows and the masks and are we, you know, going to be shut down or all these other things are going on at the same time.
You know, I do feel that, and I had a lot more optimism going into the beginning parts of my shows, and I'm starting to feel that same wet blanket kind of creeping in, and it does cripple me. And I was having such a productive time getting ready to go into these last two shows, and I was super happy with the way my booth looked, and I was like, this is everything I want to show. It's all the different stories that I want to tell. And I was really happy and getting ready to kind of, I do have kind of a narrative in my booth and in
for
my
sure
work.
Do. Yeah, I love it.
But parts of those stories are gone. And I've got to replace those parts of the stories with different images and different pieces. But I'm getting back and man, I was back in the studio and just this impending doom of, it just feels like the beginning of 2020 again to me. And I just started slowing down.
But that's a social media induced thing. I honestly have to take breaks from it because there are a lot of people sitting home with their phones professing their worries and their concerns out there. We really just need to keep ourselves positive and motivated and excited and enthused. So that's my advice anyway.
Well, thank you, Ted Lasso. I appreciate that little kick in the pants. It's a way to stay positive. High five, tree.
Well, I'll be home for 2 weeks working on my glass furnace that's broken down. So maybe I'll need a pep talk from you here next week. So we'll see what happens.
I'll give you one. You can count on me for that. I'll be there. I don't know. I've got a couple of days here in the studio that I can probably pep myself back up. I've got a new image that I want to create. So let's see how it goes.
That's great.
You know what? Let's take us out of that and into our conversation for the week with Amber Marshall. She's one of your glass buddies and one of my just straight up buddies. I love her and her partner, Mike. And it always brightens my street if I know they're close by. They're hilarious people. I'm glad you sat down with her and talked about her because I would have just sat down and made fart noises into the mic.
That's great. Yeah. And, you know, after talking with Amber, it was my first time meeting the two of them. And then I saw Mike on the road the last two shows. And we've been having just a great time, him and I shooting the shit. And probably I've spent more time talking to Mike the last couple of weeks than my 1 hour chat with Amber. But those guys are awesome. It's been really fun. And it was really fun talking about our medium, the medium that gives me such enthusiasm and passion.
Well, the passion is what we all kind of strive to have as the backbone of our art career. And it's a talk. It's not a glass talk. You do nerd out a couple of times with a glass talk, and that's no big deal. But we can all relate because we can all relate to, I don't know, the passion of our own careers.
Well, the thing I really wanted to share about this particular story, and bear with me here, this is a little bit of a story, but when I started glass blowing back in 93, that's when Chihuly was exploding on the scene and Chihuly started becoming a household name.
Don't you have to say it like Chihuly?
Chihuly. Chihuly. Anyway, yeah, he's hanging his chandeliers over the Venice waterways and throwing floats in the canals and everything. That's when he started really exploding on the scene.
Right. Which is, it's like he's kind of, he exists as kind of a rock star in your field. He's a little bit, he's a rock star, but he's also a little bit of a Guy Fieri of blown glass.
Well, what people might not really know is that, okay, so he is the face of the American glass movement. You know, glass, contemporary American glass started about two decades earlier than that's when it kind of started. But it was in the 90s when Chihuly met Lino Tagliapietra from Italy. And Lino brought all of the trade secrets from Venice that were family secrets handed down for generations. And it was their partnership that made contemporary glass what it is now. What it was the technique combined with this almost Renaissance-like creativity and passion. And even though Chihuly gets the notoriety and the name recognition, Lino is really the driving force behind the technique and the skill. So my point to this long-winded story is that glass partnerships are vital in our business and our line of work. And I'm so grateful for my partnership with Renee. There's a lot of great husband-wife teams out there. You've got Mike and Amber, Paul and Carol, Jeremy and Chelsea, Jim and Renee, Karen and Angelo. We push each other. We create together. We physically need two people to do and execute the work, but also having a second set of eyes for designing the work. It's really important and it's really, really great. And I feel really honored to be working in this medium.
Yeah, that's really interesting. My wife and I sat down and talked about art partnerships, and they exist in glass. They exist in lots of different other ones. Like there are true partnerships all up and down, and it's cool to see them. Sometimes those partnerships are relegated to a supporting role, as opposed to the frontline. Chihuly is the Mick Jagger, and the other guy who I've already forgotten his name.
Lino.
Yeah, I forgot. It went into my head again. But you know what I mean? It's kind of like you've got the frontline rock star, and then sometimes you have the behind the scenes artist, and they are just as crucial. You know, I mean, Genna is just as crucial as the front of the painting that Signy does of the Grushchenko's work. So it's interesting to see those partnerships that happen.
Well, why don't we jump into this and get to hear a little bit from Amber's voice about how her and Mike work and a little bit about how she got into this.
Perfect. Let's do it.
All right. Here is Amber Marshall.
This episode of the Independent Artist Podcast is brought to you by Zap, the digital application service where artists and art festivals connect.
Douglas, I'm thrilled this week that we are being sponsored and supported by Zapplication.org.
It's great that they appreciate what we're doing.
And I appreciate what they are doing, basically because I feel like I'm an intensely lazy man. And they make the entire art show process, signing up for shows, a lot easier.
You know, they just added that tagging feature so that we can mark what shows we're trying to build that perfect tour. We can keep an eye on when the deadlines are to make sure that we kind of line our shows up the way we want them to go next year.
Or you can write whatever you want on it. You can write, hey, this show sucked last year, but it had promise. It's going to be exactly what you need it to be. And I appreciate that extra bonus feature.
Yeah. I'm excited to welcome to the Independent Artist Podcast, Amber Marshall. Amber is based in Spruce Pine, North Carolina. However, she strongly identifies with her roots as a Midwesterner. She comes from people who are stubbornly independent, who made things both out of necessity and for fulfillment. The kind of physical work that gets your hands dirty and leaves you exhausted at the end of the day. Amber has been representing and selling her glass at fine art festivals for several years, jurying into top shows and garnering many awards along the way. Her most notable distinction is the inclusion of her work in the 2021 Toyama International Glass Exhibition. She has quite a busy schedule, so we appreciate her taking the time and spending it here with us today. Well, hey, Amber, welcome to the Independent Artist Podcast.
Thanks, Jed.
Thanks for joining us today. This is fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you on Zoom. So it's embarrassing to say we've been in the same orbit for 10 years and this is the first time we've met. So,
well, it's hard, you know, if someone's not your neighbor, it's kind of difficult to like get to know someone. You can't be like farting around outside your booth too much, even though I'm very guilty of that.
Well, yeah. And how often do they put two glass blowers side by side where you can sit and chat the whole weekend?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So did you keep up the same crazy blowing schedule over COVID or was it just when you felt like it or needed to?
Well, we were at La Quinta when the shit started hitting the fan.
Yeah.
And we were driving home as things were shutting down.
Okay.
So the furnace was on. We were like ready to roll. And when we got back and we started realizing like nothing is going to happen, we try to maintain a schedule and take a new approach like, oh, well, we're just going to make stock. We're mm-hmm. just going to make sure we have plenty of stock for when things do start to open up. But at some point when you have so much stuff sitting around in totes, it's like, what the fuck are we doing?
Uh-huh.
It was really hard to get motivated. So yeah, we kept a regular schedule for a while. And then things just started to feel bleak and we're like, it was hard for us to get in there and do stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we tried to take a new approach like, oh, well, let's try some things. Let's try to make some new work. But that was also difficult.
Yeah.
Just like feeling inspired right. or think you have all this time. All of a sudden your life is slow, which is what you want. But you don't necessarily feel good about it. So it's not like we were oozing with creativity, you know?
I literally, within a month before, this was like, you know, the 2020 Florida season. We just came off doing an installation and we were heading right into like show after show after show. And I turned to Renee and I go, I need a break. I really, really need a break. And I was serious. I was thinking we were just going to have to slow down. And she's used that against me all through COVID. She's like, are you happy we've got this break? Not against me, but she liked to bring it up teasingly, you know?
Yeah, of course, of course. Yeah, I mean, I probably, like a lot of people, am experiencing whiplash right now, where we were always running on all cylinders all the time and didn't know any different. And then when the brakes were put on, and we realized how fast and how hard and how awful we were going. It's like, oh, okay. I don't think I can or want to return to that pace.
I'm with you. Totally.
It's not good for me. And you know, like I've only had 3 shows maybe, and I'm like overwhelmed. I'm not saying that I've ever been a well-oiled machine because that's a lie. Mm-hmm. It's always like, I mean, not quite my first rodeo, but like the third. Mm-hmm. And each show I've done this year has been like, there's been some trial and tribulation with setup. Like, oh my God, I don't know how to set up on an unlevel surface. How do I do it? I mean, I've felt so stupid and so defeated.
Oh. Are you saying like the shims you would have normally traveled with you didn't have, or it was just like...
In all honesty... Mike helps me usually set up my booth. Mm. He stayed home from Old Town. Mm. His mother had passed and we were having a rough spring and a friend of mine was willing to go with me. And I was like, oh yeah, we got this, no problem. Mm. And that experiment was so awful. It's like, oh no, Mike cannot have any days off.
He really felt appreciated after that weekend, God. I'm like, sure.
You know, I didn't remember the street being so unlevel and my brain just can't work out that equation. And luckily there some really nice people that helped me. Otherwise, I was like ready to walk away. Like, fuck this. I can't do this.
Old town streets are especially slopey. I mean, I know that I've set my back leg on the actual curb and it's the same level as the where the front leg lands in the street. It's that extreme of a drop. Oh,
yeah. And I couldn't get my brain around it. And since this is an art fair podcast, most people probably know the delightful Michael Schwegman walked by.
Oh, yeah.
And saw me like falling apart, like near meltdown. And he's like, you need some help?
Oh, it was good timing that he came in and was he able to help you out?
Oh, my God. Forever grateful. Yes. Oh. He's the best.
Yeah. So, but I had kind of a interesting experience a few years back. I hope this worked out the way I planned it, but did you at Fort Worth have a Good Samaritan return a piece of work of yours that had gotten stolen?
Yes.
I pointed them in the right direction.
Oh, that was you? That Thank was you. Yes, that was so bizarre because, you know, there's no street value to glass. I've had things stolen out of my booth before only to find them like stashed in another booth. They steal something and they're like, what the fuck do I do with this? And then they like stash it in someone else's booth, you know?
So what happened when they returned your piece?
They were very nice people that owned a bar somewhere near downtown and the vessel was completely drenched. Like something had been inside of it.
So here's what they told me. They said that there was a brown paper bag around it.
Oh my God.
And it was cinched at the top. So this piece, one of your dappled vases, which you are making to not be a functional piece.
Sure.
They made it functional. They actually probably drank liquor out of it is what I'm guessing.
Well, as long as they didn't pee in it. I mean, I think I eventually like ended up selling that piece later on, not at that show because it was pretty beat up. I had to go home and fix it up.
Oh, did it get scraped up?
Yeah, you know, the acid etched surface. Mm. So it doesn't have to be babied, but if it gets scratches, you gotta spruce it back up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so who knows? But I was shocked that anyone would steal those. What are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with that?
I do feel that way with blown glass. It is unusual for us to ever have theft. Not that it doesn't happen, but you know, things don't usually walk away as if, you know, we were jewelers or something.
Mike actually had a little vase stolen at Winter Park this year, if I remember correct. He makes these little sweet little cane bottles and he had them out on a front shelf and he went back and he's like, where did that piece go? I didn't sell it.
Wow.
So
crazy.
It was definitely like a purse size object.
Yeah. Well, I saw on your Instagram, your really big news about the International Glass exhibition that you're part of.
This is put on by Toyama Museum of Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have a fairly prestigious glass blowing institution attached to it. And it's a triennial. It's an international competition, and I happen to have some glassblowing friends that are guest instructors there for 3 years. Mm. Another husband and wife glassblowing team.
Cool.
And she was encouraging me to apply, and I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But she kept encouraging me, and I didn't want to blow her off because I respect her so much. I applied. Remarkably got into the show, which was surprising and really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It is actually a competition. So once all the work is up, the jurors will award, I think, 7 cash prizes, the biggest being like $30,000.
Wow.
Yeah, something bonkers. I think it goes 30,000, 10, and then some smaller ones. And then if you're the 30,000, you will become a part of the permanent collection.
Wow.
Which would be super cool.
Yeah. And you said your friends encouraged you to apply for it?
Yes. They're teaching in Toyama right now.
I see.
And she had sent me a text saying, I really think you should apply. I think your aesthetic fits this competition and fits what they like in Japan. And she was also saying, you know, like, I really think you should get your work in front of these eyes, which was the judging panel. It's curators of Corning Museum of Glass, of Museum of Ebeltoft, which I probably said wrong, but it's in Denmark. And so a lot of like young female contemporary curators. So yeah, it was really surprising and awesome to be accepted.
Well, it's well-deserved. Your work is amazing. And what you're doing is really cutting edge and has a real fresh aesthetic. And I was excited when I saw that on your Instagram. And it was kind of cool how you did the scroll. And then you kind of scroll down. But it's like, what is she showing us? What is she showing us? And then we see her work. It's like, whoa. It was like a big reveal. It was super exciting.
I do so little on Instagram that I feel like each post needs to, not that that was like a great post or anything, but I do so little. Every time I do something, there's a lot of pressure. Like, oh, this better be fucking good. Like, you never post, so at least post something interesting or what you think might be interesting. I never know.
The whole Instagram thing is new to me, and it's a whole different market than Facebook. And that's what I've been using for years. And I've learning from Marjolyn Vanderhart, who did our second episode talking about marketing your work through social. And it feels like I'm so out of touch with knowing how to do any of it, but I don't know.
I am also very out of touch, and I know that it's an incredible tool to use, but I just can't do it. I don't know. I'm just like, haven't been able to jive with it. And I actually hired someone last summer to sort of help me work through that. That's why there's as many glass posts as there are now, but I was kind of a bad client.
Right, because it seems like we're used to using it on our own, kind of like what we like to look at, you know, personally and professionally. But when we try and use it as a means to represent our work, it is almost, we have to take our personality out of the whole thing and create engagement with our work. But then the thing that drives us all crazy that, well, how many people engaged? It can send you to the nut house.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't feel like a healthy arena for me. As an anxious person. And also, like, I never joined Facebook for that reason. Like, I knew that I couldn't. At the time, I thought, oh, I can't handle this. I don't think I should dip my toes in this. But then, Instagram's the same for me. I want to get more comfortable because it's ridiculous not to use it.
Yeah, and using it in the right way and all that kind of stuff. It's a learning experience.
I admire all the people that can and do use it to sell work and promote shows. It's like, it's such a skill. And I don't know why I make it so hard for myself. It's like I'm always tripping over my own feet, or like, I don't know why I make it so fucking hard for me to just do it, you know? Post you're going to a show, post you got an award. Like, just, it's not that hard, you know?
Well, I wonder, this is going to kind of jump a little forward in some stuff I've read about you and did some kind of a little bit of the research or the deep dive into what you have out there. And you talk a lot about how coming from the Midwest really affects your relationship with glass, and you really identify with being a Midwesterner. And I'm also from the Midwest. I grew up, I was born and raised in Iowa and moved to Minneapolis, and I'm in Western Wisconsin now. But that kind of Midwestern mentality is not one to like toot your own horn and do an Instagram post, look how great I am. It kind of feels really foreign and uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I think that there's also some personality traits in there that squished in with the Midwesternness.
Okay.
So yeah, I don't know. I'm sure there's something to that. That's the other thing that I don't even understand about being Midwestern is like, what can I attribute to my geographical upbringing and what is actually just me, you know? I mean, I'm with you on that.
Well, when I read what you said about your relationship with glass and coming from the Midwest, it's like from kind of that blue collar mentality, that getting your hands dirty, working really hard, trying to solve problems, being stubbornly independent, wrestling this material that we work with, this glass, to get an outcome. And at the end of the day, we've just been run through the ringer, and you kind of feel like, okay, I've accomplished something today because my body is wiped out. I'm tired. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I am very attracted to that quality of glass blowing. A little bit less so as I'm getting older, but that's what brought me into it at first. And I'm also attracted to like backpacking for days. You know, it doesn't sound like a vacation for a lot of people, but I like it when it kind of hurts a little bit. And then when you're done, the pizza tastes the best that you've ever had. And that kind of thing feels rewarding for me. If it's easy, I'm usually not that interested.
Oh, okay. Do you have an athletic background?
Yeah, actually, I grew up playing volleyball and basketball, and played volleyball almost year round on travel teams and stuff. Mm-hmm. I found that a lot of my friends that are glassblowers are clay artists, grew up as athletes. Have you found that?
My wife and I have different connections to glass for different reasons. And she comes to it because of being a soccer player. And she was in art school and she did all different kinds of mediums, but nothing really fit until she saw glass blowing. And it was the physicality of glass blowing that hooked her from the second she started it. And so I've always thought there is kind of a draw to people who are in athletics, because we're like, you know, doing one thing with one hand while we're working with the other hand, and we're moving through space, and it's a total dance. The glass is moving and we're moving, and it's a coordinated kind of thing.
And also, one thing that I think about is that I spent most of my childhood and teenage years doing practice and skills. You know, like you go to volleyball practice and you do the same skill over and over and over and over and over and over again. And then you finally see some improvement. And that's the exact same with glass blowing. You know, if you want to learn how to drop a blown foot, you do it for 3 hours for weeks, you know, then. Even then, you might still suck, but
Or I think about when we try and experiment with new work, and you take that time. You, let's say we're going to set aside a week or 2 weeks, and you think, okay, well, this is plenty of time to work through it. And you try some experimental stuff, and you look at it, and you're like, this is like student work. you know what I mean? Until you've refined it, there is that muscle memory of doing things over and over and over again before it can kind of become second nature.
It's funny that you say that about student work. And since this is about art fairs, I'll bring it back to an art fair. But I started making some new vessels, I guess it was 2011. I maybe got into some art fairs I shouldn't have. And my work was okay, but it wasn't refined. And, you know, years later, I'm still going to the same art festivals. And this woman comes up to me and is like, oh, you know what? I think I bought some of your work when you were just a student. Did you show here when you were a student? And I was like, oh, I was so mortified because, you know, yeah, sure.
Whatever makes the story feel a little sweeter for her, I guess.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that's so embarrassing. No, I was probably out of school for like 8 years already.
You know, I am totally positive that she wanted to create a story around it, and she realized it had been a long time. And if you've been doing it for this long, it must have been like when you were just a little kid, just started blowing glass or something.
Yeah. Well, also the reality of the situation is that form that I was making was kind of hard, and I kept making it for years, and it got astronomically better. And so she got one of the like kind of dumpy early versions that was, you know.
So she gave her honest feedback.
Yeah. And I can't blame her. She's not wrong. She's definitely not wrong. But it was just like, oh, shit. That's embarrassing.
You suddenly feel like you're standing there, you know, naked in front of her, like, oh, man, I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, like, why couldn't the housekeeper have broken that one?
Right.
But, yeah.
You didn't start college with the intention of being an artist. You started in a different field.
Yeah. As we mentioned before, I come from a blue-collar family. My dad was a mechanic, and then he sold his shop and bought an auto salvage yard.
Okay.
And so My brother went to college. My eldest brother went to college, but he had a dropout. So I was going to be the first college graduate. Okay. And in my family's mind, you go to college to jump up a level, you know, like you go to be a fucking doctor. You go specifically to be an eye doctor or a pharmacist is what I was supposed to do. Right. You know, it's supposed to be like an economic jump forward.
I see.
Because otherwise, like, why are we putting all this money and effort into it? Mm-hmm. So that was the original intention. And then I went to college and quickly fell in love with sociology and was a sociology major. And I don't know if you've done this with your kids or if this still exists, but there used to be this like chart of like, if you're a sociologist, you make this much money a year. Mm-hmm. And if you're a blah, blah, blah. And so when they saw what a sociologist made for the year, they were like, what?
That's it?
You're going to do what? And so then when I totally shifted gears and decided to become an art major, it was even more of like a
What?
So not super excited or supportive of some decisions I was making, but they've come around to it.
Right. And so the college you were at, was it like a hometown college or did you travel somewhere to go?
Oh, I jumped around quite a bit. God, we're going into the weeds, Doug.
Okay.
So, I got into a really good school called Wake Forest University in North Carolina, and I had quite a bit of scholarships, and there was a lot of pressure for me to stay there and do well. I got there, and I hated it. I came home Christmas break, and I told my mom, I hate it. And she's like, too bad, you're staying. So I went back, and like I was barely there a week, and I call her, and I'm like, I'm dropping out. And she's like, well, don't come home.
Wow.
Well, don't come home. We've got nowhere
to
go. So it was a tumultuous time. And so from there, I kind of jumped around, like, because she was upset with me because she had sacrificed so much for me to go to the school and I quote unquote threw it away.
Yeah.
She was really upset. And so I kind of ping-ponged around state schools, community college, just like whatever I could piece together. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was taking acting classes and sculpture classes.
Are you kidding me? You have a theater background too?
No, but I was convinced I wanted to be a soap opera actress because I thought like, that looks so fucking fun. Like you just go to work and act stupid all day. Like I want to do that so bad. And so I took a couple of acting classes. And the first audition I went to, I don't even know if I waited in line. I don't even know if I don't remember if I did the audition. I just quickly realized like, oh, you don't have the guts for this. That dream is over. You're not going to be on Days of Our Lives. You're not going to die 9 times. You know, that's not what's going to happen for you. But I was just trying out lots of different things.
That's good. And then, so what led you to picking up the blowpipe for the first time and starting to work with glass?
I saw an exhibition at the St. Louis Art Museum of Chihuly, actually. Mm-hmm. And
go figure.
Yeah. What do you know? And I was just like totally enamored. Like, what is this stuff? And I was actually at this school in Chicago at the time, University of Illinois, and I went to the library and I just started getting all these books on glass blowing and trying to figure out like, what is this? How do you do it? I don't understand it.
Wow.
And I was trying to find places to do it. There weren't any glass blowing studios in Chicago at that time because of all these ordinances from the great Chicago fire, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville, which was next to my parents' house. And I could go there for nothing. It was a 400 level art class. So I called the instructor and I was just like, I don't know. I was in 100 level art and I begged him. I was like, please let me in.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. Mm-hmm. And it was awesome. And I was able to pick up tons of blow slots. Like any slot that someone didn't want, I would just pick up. Right. Even if it was like, I don't know. I was just so into it so fast.
We were the same way. It was like we were working a full-time job in the hot shop, just getting our hands dirty, learning how it worked and, you know, what glass at 2,100 degrees was like versus when it gets to 800 degrees and falls on the floor. You know, you learn those those parameters and those thresholds of what you're working with, and trial and error, tons of trial and error.
Oh yeah. And the program, I mean, I don't even think you could call it a program. The school I was at, the older students taught the younger students. Mm-hmm. So my mentor, and this won't mean anything to other people than glassblowers, but my mentor was teaching me how to put a jack line in with a file. And I was like, I don't know much, but this seems wrong.
Oh, it is. It's like you sometimes you get people who don't know much in positions of teaching, and you could be power, spinning your wheels for years.
I mean, I know.
And then you've got people who are out and out just trying to like sabotage too. I mean,
there's always some like overly confident men in the hot shop that maybe the confidence is unfounded or like
yeah,
can't really back it up, but somehow they got it.
Oliver and I were just talking, and his partner David and I were talking about this condition where people, where certain people or personality types, they get a little bit of knowledge and they think they know everything. And then there's people who've got a lot of knowledge and they think they know nothing, you know, or they, you know, so there's just the spectrum.
Yeah, that's so true. Mm-hmm. And you go to a public glass studio and you're going to get the full spectrum.
Right, exactly.
Every time.
Yeah. And this is an art form where we rely on partners. We rely on, it's very challenging to even just open a glory hole door when your glass is screaming hot. And, you know, you need somebody there to do the stupid little things, or you've got glass on the floor all oozed off the end of the blowpipe.
Yeah. Or you need some moisture on your newspaper pad.
I know. It's almost like, you know, the doctor saying scalpel.
Yeah. Close. Stop. Yeah. Water. Open. Close. Punty. Thank you. Bye. Fuck.
So we have a similar situation in we work with our lifetime partners in glass. So tell me about your partnership with Mike.
Oh, man. I don't even know where to begin. Mike is awesome.
Yeah, he is.
Mike is pretty awesome. Clearly, I can't set my booth up without him. He's the numbers guy. He's the shit.
Yeah. Did you guys actually meet at the public access studio that you...
Yes, we met in St. Louis at a place called Third Degree Glass Studio.
Okay.
It's on Del Mar, so maybe people that have gone to the St. Louis Art Fair have ventured down there.
Cool.
He was fresh out of college and he was helped building the equipment and start the studio. I was mildly fresh out of college and trying to find a job. And every Christmas, my mom would want me to make these glass icicles.
Okay.
It was kind of in the beginning where there weren't a lot of public access studios. So when this opened up, it was super cool. And it was really amazing that it was near my hometown. And so I rented some time to make my mom some icicles.
And was it for her personally or to give as Christmas gifts? Or?
Oh, both, you know.
Right.
It's, you know, I feel so bad for the years of bad glass Christmas presents my family has received.
Don't you wish you could go in the middle of the night and sneak in and take all the early work out and get rid of it?
Yeah. In my very, very beginning glassblowing, I would, you know, bring stuff home and then throw it away. And one day I went into my parents' bathroom and this thing that I had deliberately thrown away was on the back of my dad's toilet with Q-tips in it. And I was like...
I could relate to that one for sure.
No, this goes back in the trash. This can't just be an artifact of my bad job forever.
It is funny. I know I've had relatives come over and we did the same and they're digging through. I'm like, but this has a hole in the bottom of it. They're like, we don't care. No one can see the bottom.
out here in Spruce Pine, we don't have trash pickup. We have to take our trash to the transfer station. Uh-huh. And so I had, and this is probably a couple years ago, but I had taken a bunch of glass that I was just sick of looking at and like threw it all away. Mm. And some of it was broken and some of it wasn't. I found out later, my friend had gone to the transfer station and the man that runs the transfer station was like, going on and on and on about how his wife had found these beautiful glass cases in the trash. And you know what? That makes me fucking happy that, like, it's not in a landfill and it's making someone else happy. Like,
I know.
Good on them. But just as long as it's, like, not in my parents' house and a reminder to me.
Yeah.
I do
sometimes look over our life and all the little shiny pieces that are out in the world. And I kind of think, you know, like a little light sitting on all the collector's little mantles and all the happiness and joy that it might have given them. And it makes you kind of feel a little happy and a little bit accomplished that people have your stuff and they enjoy your stuff and it affects their life. And it's kind of a good feeling.
Yeah. Better than feeling like you're just sucking up resources and making trash.
Yeah, right. Totally. So you guys met at the public access studio, and how did you get out of the St. Louis area and make your way out to the East Coast?
Well, we both worked there for a very long time. I think at like the 8 or 9 year mark, I was just totally burnt out. I was teaching glassblowing classes, both as a satellite campus through Washington University, and then also third degree glass factory had public glass classes, beginning classes on 6 week cycles. Cool. So every 6 weeks, you're teaching a totally new group of people all over again. As you know, as a glass blower, those are like the hardest, absolutely the hardest weeks of teaching. And I was so burnt and I was going through a divorce. I applied for a residency at Penland School of Crafts and the Energy Exchange, which is near Penland School of Crafts in Burnsville. Right. Penland School of Crafts being very prestigious. Right. I did not get that. I did not deserve it. My application was terrible. I did, however, get the Energy Exchange residency. Mm. It was billed as a business incubator and a subsidized studio. So they had built a glass studio, a ceramic studio, and a greenhouse using landfill gas to heat the furnace and the glory hole to fire a clay kiln and to keep the greenhouse warm when they needed to. I got in on the tail end when the place, it was not getting the funding it needed. It was kind of falling apart. Mm-hmm. I didn't really care because I just needed something else to do. Mm-hmm. So I moved here. Did that residency for about a year and a half. Issues with the gas started happening. Okay. And when I say landfill gas, like on the high end, it's filtered and it's like, you're running great. Mm-hmm. But this is on the low end. I mean, there was this one time I went in and I lit the equipment. It was in the wintertime. There's no filter. The flame would be blue, green, yellow, or just like all kinds of crazy colors. I went in, I lit the equipment. All of a sudden, I started just like feeling funny. Like, oh man, I can't feel my face. That's weird. I can't feel my teeth. Where, you know, it was just like, just so weird.
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh fuck, I'm getting poisoned right now.
Holy fuck.
I am definitely getting poisoned right now. And so I went outside, I like opened the doors and I went outside and I got some fresh air and I was like, this is insane. This is totally insane. Like, it seemed like a great idea, but this is terrible. And, wow. You know, it was not reliable. It was very difficult to make work there. It ended up actually being kind of expensive even. It kind of imploded. It was supposed to be 3 years. It imploded at like a year and a half. They ran out of gas.
Mm-hmm. You settled there and that became your home.
Yeah. So Mike was in St. Louis doing his job still. We weren't in a partnership yet. I lived here. He lived there. I was traveling through St. Louis on my way to Cherry Creek, actually.
Okay.
And I needed to get into third degree. And I was, like, couldn't remember the code. So I called Mike and I'm like, hey, can you let me in?
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to go get dinner? And then that was it.
Awesome. That started it off.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, years of friendship and we were glassblowing partners and stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So as that developed and he was getting burnt out, he also decided to move here because I had sort of a craft fair business set up. Like, you know, I was getting in shows. I had a booth, the whole shebang. We decided to just focus on me for a little bit. I don't even remember how long that period was, maybe like a year and a half where we just like busted ass, made so much of my work. did tons of shows. And then once that became stable and we were like making a little bit of money and became comfortable, then we took the time for like, okay, now we need to develop your side. Like, okay, what do you want to make?
Right.
So he took, I mean, it was really cool of him. He took a backseat for a couple of years and just helped me like get better and smarter. Well, he wears the smart pants.
Are you saying to get you into the marketing arena where you could have a place to sell your work? Is that what you're saying, to get better at, or just the whole thing?
Just all around consistency of my work, having a solid assistant. Mm-hmm. Before he was here, I was hiring lots of different assistants. And as you know, from working with your wife for eons, yeah, I would imagine, mm-hmm, that if you tried to work with someone else tomorrow and then another person on Wednesday or Thursday, I don't even know what day it is. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's just, it's not that easy.
It's not.
And so
having somebody who just anticipates and knows the one word cues, knows without even being told what's going on.
Yeah. And you know what to expect. You know, today we worked all day and like we hardly said in it. We don't really say that much because we don't really have to.
Right. Like, yeah.
I know what to do. He knows what to do.
And then do you have days where it is like, okay, we're working on Amber's stuff today, or the next day it's Mike's day or whatever. How do you work that?
We're not really super as structured as we used to be. Mm. When we were like in full tilt, we would either split days evenly, like you get four, I get four, mm-hmm, hours. You know, what you do with that is your business. But then sometimes, you know, I'll have a commission, I'll need more days, or he'll have a show coming up and he'll need more days, or mm-hmm, so we just, it's pretty loose, like whatever void we need to fill, or whoever's vibing on blowing.
Right. That makes sense. That's an interesting way to describe the partnership. It's almost like having two lines of work, and which line of work needs the, you know, needs the attention right now because of whatever's coming up, the show, the commission, or whatever. We'll focus on this. And then, yeah, this other thing is calling the attention. Even though it's your body of work and his body of work, you can kind of float, yeah, back and forth on it.
Yeah, it's very fluid and so far has been very balanced. I don't think either one of us feels like we're getting the shit into the stick.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been working well. And even just, mm-hmm, not having the expense of an assistant, mm-hmm, is awesome. Like, yeah, I was drowning in debt from like paying an assistant $20 an hour, 40 hours a week. Mm-hmm. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. It adds up.
Yeah.
Rent, glasses, expensive to make.
The ovens are eating money when we're off at shows. The energy dial is spinning, and if we're not making money at the shows, we're really losing money on our studio expenses.
Yeah, yeah. It's it can feel like you're in a vice grip.
Yeah. And you feel like, yeah, and you can't do it alone. We can't just like say, okay, well, Mike's off at a show, and you can just flip on the ovens and just do it. You need his assistance and vice versa. So you do shows pretty much, if you're both in the shows, you go, or do you ever have a situation where one of you gets in and just one of you goes off to do a show?
You know, we had one year where we were like pretty much we're getting into all the shows together.
Cool.
And then that started to uneven out a little bit here and there. And we have done shows where just Mike goes, just I go,
mm-hmm,
et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's more self-sufficient than I. Like, he can go without me, but clearly I can't go without him after that leveling disaster.
For the longest time, I knew of you both individually, and I didn't know you guys were a partnership. I think there's shows where you're not like next to each other. Is that right? It's almost like you're two separate exhibitors showing up at the show and just...
We are two separate exhibitors. We apply separately. We have separate everything. But we do request to be by each other.
Okay.
And some shows are really great about it. Yeah. And I really appreciate it. And then there'll be a show like Bayou City where we're 400 booths apart, and we don't get out until like 2 o'clock in the morning. And
yeah,
there have been like really horrendous situations. But for the most part, even though we are both glass and that's not ideal for a show layout, mm-hmm. I think because our work is so different, mm-hmm. shows will accommodate us for the most part.
Yeah.
And we're grateful when they do because it makes our lives so much easier.
Right.
I mean, ideal situation is back to back, which doesn't happen that often for us. We're usually side to side across the street from each other, which works, but the convenience factor goes down.
Tell me a little bit about how your partnership, you guys have maintained separate bodies of work. Because there's a lot of us partnerships out there where we've decided to work on a single body of work, but the two of you keep a separate aesthetic.
Yeah. Well, for anyone that's listening that doesn't know our work, Mike's glasswork is very pattern-based, very technical. Mine is a little more fluid and organic. We had some growing pains, and I think there was a point where we sort of thought it would make sense to combine and like come up with work that we both make. And, you know, that's still occasionally mentioned, but I need my own work. And I don't know, I think it's probably me more than him that's like saying, keeping it separate.
It's really valuable and important and a strength for you to be able to say, listen, you know, it does seem like the pressure would be for you to sacrifice your vision and your voice so that you guys could have a collective body of work. And you guys already have a partnership in life as well as a partnership in what you make. Having your own artistic vision is important and is I think if you were a male and you said, I want to make my own work and that's it, people would be like, yep, cool. But maybe there's a little bit of pressure, like maybe I should merge our work or maybe I shouldn't have my own thing or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Does that?
Yeah, I think that I don't know why it was so important for me to continue to have my own autonomy. I respect his opinion. He respects mine. I take it, you know, criticism from him. Like we give feedback. Like
yeah.
All of that is very healthy. And I guess if our aesthetics were closer, it would make more sense. Mm-hmm. But we're not at total opposite ends of the spectrum, but he's a pattern guy. Mm-hmm. It's very mathy. It's very techie. I make organic, fluid, soft looking sculpture. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying the two can't merge, but I just haven't designed or thought of a piece where I think it's appropriate yet. You know,
it's almost like that the two different approaches of working with blown glass. You do get the technical folks who are all about technique, and if you work in those patterns, and it does flow or shift off a little bit, the eye is drawn to that and it's thought of as a mistake. And yeah. There is a real strength and a real talent to being able to create fluid work that doesn't look like a mistake. You know what I mean? And there's a way to approach the glass. And I'd say we do work similarly in that way, in that we both, you know, you and Renee and I, we like the glass to resemble how it looks when we're playing with it at 2000 degrees. We're not trying to fit it into some structure that looks perfectly formed. We want it to have flow. And we had a situation where one of our pieces once came off of the pipe when we were taking it off to put into the annealing oven. It came off sooner than we were planning on it, and it landed on the crack-off table and it squished flat. Well, we put it away thinking it was garbage, but we still wanted to see it the next day. And it was from that point on, this particular series became a flattened oval series because we liked how it flowed and what it did. And we worked with it, and that's the direction that we went with it.
When people see the flattened oval in your booth, I don't know exactly what piece you're talking about, so yeah. I don't mean this in any insulting way, but yeah. When people come into your booth, do they say, oh, well, isn't that a happy accident? Oh. Did you do that? They I get that all the time about those poof wall sculptures that look like deflated glass.
Really?
Yeah. People say that often, like, oh, this was a mistake, right?
I love your poof series because as a glass worker, that shriveled look, that inhaled kind of like a deflated bubble or something. It looks fluid. It looks like it's moving. It's alive. And that's what I love about that series.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
But I guess maybe because I know how glass is, I'm actually surprised that somebody would walk in your booth and make that comment like they thought it was an accident or a happy accident.
Oh my God. You would not believe the things I hear. The first time I'm like making poofs. Yeah. Maybe second. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. Uh-huh. But I make these white poofs and I'm like, I like these. These are great. And mm-hmm. I don't normally, you know, I'm not like overly confident about my work all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited to take these to a show. And I paint a wall black and I've got these white poofs and I'm like, oh, you know, cloud reference, all this stuff.
Yeah.
At Fort Worth. And you know that show? It's just like millions of people, like all day, every day. From like Thursday to Sunday, walked by and said, those look like deflated breast implants. Those look like deflated breast implants.
Oh boy.
All day long from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. or whatever the fucking time that show closes. It was like grandmothers, aunts, grandchildren. Like,
you're kidding. Across the board, that was just the...
Yes, yes, all day. And I was like, Mike, hey, serious design flaw. I've really fucked up here. I have designed deflated breast implants.
Well, how did you get past that? How did they get to where they are now?
Well, they look the same. And I started to think that it's a Rorschach test on the community.
Yeah.
Because you go to other places like Artisphere and Greenville is like so sweet. And they're like, oh, these look like beautiful clouds and jellyfish. And it's just like a total different reaction. But also I think that context matters. So yeah. Instead of white on black, which I thought was pretty simple, blue and gray, those references aren't as strong.
Yeah, that's a good point. Something else that I find in common about our work is maybe you have felt the pressure over the years from a collector or from people that want big work. And there's plenty of big guys out there who can really turn out the really large pieces to fit in these niches and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We don't work that big, but what we started to do was we started to look at our work as installation pieces and as collections and how mm-hmm. multiple forms can create that impact to meet the demand of what people are asking for when it comes to, you know, we don't want to blow a vessel that's 3 feet long or something, but we can do multiple pieces that can achieve that effect.
Totally. Yes. That has been the key to my recent success. How Midwestern I feel weird saying I've had success. did that come off arrogant?
You're getting awards for that work. You're selling commissions in those works. I mean, I've seen the marketing you're putting out in people's homes and they are outstanding and they are contemporary. And you had the vision and you put it out there in Fort Worth and had that reaction. You could have gone home and been like, oh, this is a flop. This is a failure and not pushed it into a new direction to what it is now. So that's really a testament to your conviction, to your vision and what you were designing.
I didn't go home feeling great after that show. But I still just, I thought they were cool.
Cool. Awesome. Well, one thing, when you're working with collections, it's not just about designing the pieces themselves, but it's also looking at the negative space and how that plays into what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. I think it's super important because it's a whole other relationship that you're creating and whole other... I mean, even with something as simple as the dapple vases, mm-hmm. the negative space between them and how they interact with each other, they can have a familial relationship, like mother-child. They can have mm-hmm. like conversations. I think that stuff is so fun, like putting different forms next to each other and seeing what new life they have when they're together. Mm-hmm. Sounds stupid or hokey, but
no, it's
you know
not.
What I mean? Like you can put a few things together and all of a sudden there's a conversation, like yeah. There's a flow.
I do remember the standards with applying for shows where it would say, you know, you need to have one piece per image.
Oh, yeah, I've gotten in trouble for that.
Oh, well, I was going to ask about that because we had been designing collections of pieces. It wasn't like we were making a table full of tumblers, you know what I mean? Where it's like a product right. shot. It was yeah. like these three specific pieces are interacting with each other and it is a piece. Even though they're three whatever parts, yeah. they yeah. are a whole. And we would get the email back saying, you can't use this image to apply because it's more than one piece. It's like, so you've yeah. had the same deal?
I have, and it's been so long. That I don't remember exactly which show it was or how I responded to it, but almost all of my images have multiple pieces.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I've gotten away with a little bit of murder there.
That's a whole other beast is applying for shows and
yeah.
having people really understand what the work is and all that. Tell me about what's the name on the wall pieces that you're doing with the cane work and you're folding them over to look like
the stringers. Those are called gather studies.
Uh-huh.
When I turned 40, here we go, Doug. Here we go. When I turned 40, I was like, you know what? I want to get some sort of prestigious residency. And so mm-hmm. I started applying to some residencies, Corning Museum of Glass, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Didn't get them.
Okay.
Got my feelings hurt.
Okay.
And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to have a self-funded residency.
All right.
You know, like days that we didn't have scheduled a blow, I would go in by myself and just do whatever I wanted to do. I didn't have to worry about, is it saleable? Is it going to match someone's sofa? Right. I just like went in and had some fun. And out of that, I mean, it was a necessity that like, I had to make them myself. Like I needed to be self-sufficient.
Uh-huh.
And so the gather study is everybody can make stringers and you can make hundreds of stringers in a day. And then from there, the possibilities are endless.
Wow.
And so I just started toying around with that. Yeah. And I really love doing them. I'm excited about them. I have big ideas to push them further and bigger.
Yeah.
The problem is they're not great for art fairs. They're super fragile. It's not something that you can like set up easy and take down and you don't want lots of like fingernails clicking on them and you don't want.
So you have people tapping on your work with their fingernails too. That drives me nuts.
Oh, all the time. And you know what I have done, which, you know, the old pros already know this. So you're going to be like, oh, Amber, duh. I don't sit in my booth anymore. I sit across the street like all the old pros do.
Okay.
And whatever happens in there, you know? It's like they want to tap some stuff, they want to lick it, whatever they want to do, it's going to happen. They can say whatever they want to say. I don't have to hear it. When I see like someone look serious, I go in.
Yeah.
When I don't, I don't. And it has saved my sanity.
Okay. Yeah.
It's changed my show life for me.
All right. Cool. We don't make enough time to do what you did with getting into that series where you just say, this is some time. I'm just going to play and see what comes out of it and give yourself just the time to experiment. I mean, I know that on your Instagram, you showed with how you put them in front of the glory hole on the plate and you pick them up and flip them around and make them real taffy-like. That process video is super interesting to people who don't know how glass actually works when it's hot like that. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. One of the things that I want to do is get more process heavy information in my booth and on my website and on Instagram, because I think if you just look at my work, it can come off as pretty simple visually. And I think that once you see how it's actually made and how tedious it actually can be, that maybe it'll bring a different level of appreciation. Now, like, will that equate into sales? I don't fucking know. But
I know. I always feel like the grass is always greener. I feel like if we make, and when I say simple, I don't mean easy, but I mean a simple aesthetic where it's like,
yeah,
when you look at it, it's not like all the bells and whistles and the wraps and the this. And then I feel like that maybe isn't appreciated for what it is. But then when you do all the other stuff, then it becomes all about the tricks and the technique. And then you wish you could do the more simple, elegant stuff. So, I mean, it always feels like the grass is greener. And
yeah, totally. I think with my work and the aesthetic being clean and fairly minimal, that can be brushed aside. Like, oh, you just put scrunchies on the wall. Oh, you just made, are those blue noodles? Oh, you just popped a milk jug. You know, like all these references that are very banal and pedestrian, and like the visual references are not great for me sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I need to figure out a way to communicate to people better. Like, oh no, it isn't just like,
right. But that's what
it's just like 5,000 steps to make this one little scrunchy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, part of it is we're in front of the masses.
Yeah.
And so there is a huge amount of people walking these shows that aren't even coming to buy blown glass sculpture for their walls. So they just are going to say whatever stuff comes to mind and move on.
You're right.
So anyway, I don't want to end this talk without the issue of representation. And that, you know, that's a really big topic. And when we think of glass blowers over the years, it is a pretty male dominated field. And I think it is awesome that you are on an upward trajectory. You're at the top of your game. You're making some awesome work and getting into great shows. Have you had any experiences that seem like being a female glass blower that have been struggles for you?
Well, first of all, thanks for all those nice things you said about me.
Oh, yeah.
that was nice. I'll keep you around, Doug.
I'll come sell your work. How does that sound?
Yeah, totally. Please. Someone else should do it. I just bumblefuck through it. It's another one of those subjects that, like, it's so vast.
Yes.
Like, and I've had really terrible experiences and I've had really great experiences.
I get that this topic is, it's hard to kind of pin down because there are so many little subtleties along the way. And even when I see stuff, because my wife is a glass blower, like when the customer walks in the booth and her name tag says artist, and they'll look at her and they'll say, "Are you the wife?" And she'll be just like, "Are you serious?" People think of the glass blower as male. And do you ever have that experience?
Oh, for sure. Mike looks very much not like anyone that could be named Amber. And in my booth for the longest time, it doesn't exist anymore, but I had this, huge vinyl letter sign that was my name. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like name tag, his tag would say assistant, the whole shebang. Mm-hmm. They would come in and compliment him on his work. They would talk to him. Yeah, it certainly has happened at shows for sure. Mm-hmm. But you know, when I've talked to other artists in other mediums, it also happens everywhere. So
really?
I'm not sure.
It's specific to glass. Like a painter would even if they're.
Yeah. Yeah. It's happened to, who was I just talking to recently? I'm sorry, I have the memory of a fucking gnat, but I have talked about this with other people. You know, when you go through your art fair complaints, like, oh yeah. My God, can you believe this?
Right.
And I'll bring that up like after a day of it. Like, can you believe that so many people think that this 6'1" scruffy man is named Amber? Like, how does that make any sense whatsoever?
Right.
And then I will be shocked to hear the counter stories like, oh yeah, blah, 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 blah. And oh. I'm sorry, I don't have any specifics.
But right, yeah. So it is across mediums.
I think so. Yeah, we certainly get that. And then also like Mike is the muscle in our duo, right? Mm-hmm. So I am making larger work because Mike moves it around on the heavy end. Like I literally physically can't do it. So he is very responsible for the larger work. However, I'm still a part of it and I still do it too.
Yeah.
And so it is insulting when people come in and they think that he made the big stuff just because it's big. And it's like, yes, I couldn't make it without his strength,
right,
for sure. And his skill, obviously, he's highly skilled, but like, I still made it too.
Yeah, right.
And I was still there.
Right. If he's the one carrying it from the glory hole to the bench, but you're putting your mark on it or directing how it goes, it's your vision, it's your design, it's your work. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, like I've often struggled because there have been moments where it's like, oh, maybe I should just take myself out of the equation. Like, yeah, just make it. And I cannot give up that control. And I think that that's maybe one of the things when you were talking about husband and wife teams and how to work the partnership and why do you keep your work separate? It's like, I think it might be me. I think that I need to be a part of it or else it doesn't feel authentic, you know?
Right. Yeah. I remember when we had little kids and we're traveling to the shows and we realized pretty quickly that it was not good for our kids to be in cities throughout the country doing these shows. Even though Renee and I both make the work, I was going to have to be the salesperson for a while until they got through this childhood period. They needed stability. They needed mom to take care of them. And, you know, a lot of the shows understood that and were really cool about it. But there were shows that would say, well, then just take her name off the application. I'm like, I can't do that. Like, she can't. Why would we do that? She is an equal collaborator in the work. So it's just like a total misunderstanding of an artist in this particular field.
Yeah.
How it gets made and how it gets designed and created.
Ugh. Also, what a like a terrible statement on our society about how mothers are treated.
Right.
Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Her name can't be on the work because she's at home raising the children. Don't get me started.
Yeah, there you go. Well, did you watch the seasons of Blown Away?
Yeah, we destroyed them. Each season we watched in one night. It was, and when we were done, we like felt like gross and bad. Like, oh my God, I can't believe we just watched the whole season in one night.
Isn't it bizarre though that we as glassblowers are that into it? Like you'd think maybe the people who don't know anything about glass would be really enthused by it. But I mean, we still watched it like that too. We binged it.
Oh my God. And like at first I was like, this is terrible. I can't watch this. I can't watch this. I don't want to watch this. And then all of a sudden, well, you know, like episode 6, Mike's like, well, we can go to bed. I was like, no. Hit play.
Almost done. This has got
to
hurt.
I want to see it win. But you know, just being at 3 shows this year, I think that's how many I've done. Someone mentions it every single city.
Everyone.
And I think that it's like been a great benefit for glass education for us. You know, like people walk in and say things like, oh my gosh, I really have a different appreciation and understanding because of Blown Away.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's awesome. Keep the seasons rolling, you know?
That's right. I actually wanted to audition for the second season, but I kept looking for it. And then the pandemic happened and I didn't even think they were probably doing it. And then all of a sudden they had launched the second season. It was ready to air sometime in the middle of the pandemic.
Well, didn't they just announce the third season tryout? Are you going to do it?
Oh, my God.
Just look at the deadline and see what it is.
All right.
Don't cut your dreams short, Doug.
Oh, man. So
I don't know. Do you think? I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, you could.
I really, well, I'm not a sculptor. I don't know much about hot sculpting at all. And it seems like they're hot sculpting heavy. I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know if I have the skin for it.
Well, they're looking for characters. They're not necessarily getting the best. They have 2 or 3 technically super skilled people that we know. And then they've got kind of like the loosey-goosey people. And then they've got a lot of newbies who are like just been blowing for a year or something.
Yeah, which seems like a really unfair setup, to be honest.
I know.
Like, well, you get a badass glass blower in there and then someone that like can barely, you know, it's just not even fair.
Like I knew on season one, it was going to be the two finalists. It was going to be Deborah and Janus at the end. I mean, I just knew it.
Sure. Would you do it if there was a couples version? Because we've had people try to encourage, like people have encouraged us like, oh, you should apply. And I'm just like, absolutely not. Unless there's a couples version.
Yes.
And then maybe.
I think I'd be more inclined to go on Survivor than Blown Away.
You know, when Survivor first came out, I was convinced that I should be on Survivor.
Serious?
And this was like, what, like 20 years ago? Yeah, I'm like watching it with my family. My family are like very loyal Survivor watchers from the beginning.
Okay.
And I was like, oh my God, I need to be on this show. And everyone looked at me and they're like, you would be the first voted off. Like,
you're like,
there's no way you would make it. And I think it's because like, I don't like being cold, hungry, or uncomfortable.
So, there you go. Like,
that's the whole thing. Show.
Amber, this has been so much fun. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for asking me. I'm honored. I don't know if I spoke of anything of interest or not.
Yes, you did.
or said anything clear or intelligent, but
you did great.
There you have it.
Thanks so much, Amber.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Doug.
All right.
Tell Will I say hi.
Will do. Talk to you later.
Bye. Bye-bye.
It was an interesting talk you just had. Douglas, thanks so much for sitting down with Amber. Amber, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. It gives us a little bit more insight into what it means to create and to create your own vision, sometimes with a helping hand.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, Will, I did it. Amber encouraged me and I applied for Blown Away.
Shut up. The glass show on
the reality show. I did it.
No
I submitted
way.
My application. She said, just do it, Doug. Just do it. So I did. I pulled it up and I'm sitting on the couch watching TV one night. I pull it up and I look and I see the deadline is in like 3 hours. I'm like, damn, nothing.
That's
like
awesome.
Make the decision and do it. I submitted it. Haven't heard from them yet, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
If anything this year has taught me is just jump in. Don't think about it. Just fucking do it. Just
yeah, do
get
it.
Inspired.
That's amazing. You know what? I believe you're going to get it. It's going to be great. I really hope that'll happen.
We'll see.
We'll be podcasting while you're on.
It'll be fun. I don't know. But either way, it's exposure. It's exposure no matter what. So we'll see what happens.
What channel is that on?
It's Netflix.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah, there's two seasons already out there. And it's basically, for anyone who doesn't know what Blown Away is, it's Top Chef for glass blowers. So check it out. You might be interested in how glass is made.
Yeah, I nerded out on that knife making show and the metal workers and things like that. I kept thinking I'd see somebody I know. But do you know anybody that's done the show yet?
Well, I know of some of the contestants, not personally, but yeah, okay. I knew of them. And yeah, I tell you, like we said in the interview, us glass blowers, we put it on and we binge the thing. It's crazy. I can't even believe it. Even though there's so much about it that is just like for the person who has no knowledge of glass. But we still found something in it that kept us motivated and interested in it.
It's a cool show. I hope you get it. That'll be awesome.
That would be a lot of fun.
Hey, I had an idea that would be kind of fun. Make this show a little bit more interactive. If anybody has any letters they'd like to write, just go to our Facebook page. You can send us a letter. When I used to do radio for 20 years, I would have people call in and ask me questions or send letters to the Facebook page. And if I didn't get them, I'd just answer a letter from the TV guide.
Okay,
so don't make us do that.
Don't make us do that.
No. If you have any questions or things you want us to address, then log on to the Facebook page at Independent Artist Podcast. You can find us pretty easily through any of those. Doug is on there all the time. And as I'm trying to keep myself more positive and off social media, we'll let Doug tote that bale.
There we go. Well, one last note before we sign off for today. We did have a contribution last week. Thank you to Eli Hellman for throwing some money our way. We really appreciate it. It was really nice talking to you at Sun Valley. And thanks so much for listening to the podcast.
Eli, thank you so much. I hope to meet you down the road on one of these other art shows. I appreciate you very much.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening this week, and we will catch you next time.
Sounds good. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by the National Association of Independent Artists. The website is naiaartists.org.
Also sponsored by Zapplication. That's zapplication.org. And while you're at it, check out Will's website at willarmstrongart.com and my website at sigrithglass.com.
Be sure to subscribe to this podcast to be notified when we release new episodes.